So we're going to talk a little bit this morning about conflict and healing in faith communities. And I'd like to begin with a story, a couple of stories possibly. When I was a newly minted minister, straight out of seminary, I was serving a very small congregation in an urban area. Camden, New Jersey, actually, if any of you know of it. It's a very depressed city. It still is very depressed. And I was serving a congregation that was the remnant of a congregation whose members had moved out as part of white flight. And those who remained now felt trapped because they could not extract their housing investment from the community because all the prices had bottomed out, and there they were. In that setting, I very quickly realized that I did not have the skills to deal with conflict in that situation. And so I found some training at Princeton, worked at it for a number of years, and have found some of those skills to be indispensable as I have done ministry now across these many years. Later, while at the Alban Institute, on the staff of the Alban Institute, I was approached by a friend and an executive in the Presbyterian congregation denomination, asking if I would be willing to take on an interim ministry situation in a large congregation that had just come through and was still coming out of a very divisive conflict situation where the congregation split. The minister renounced his credentials in the denomination, left the congregation, took 100 people with him, including some critical staff people, and went across town and opened up a storefront in the same community. When I arrived there and I was being interviewed for the interim position, I asked the interviewing group, what would you hope I could accomplish in my first 3 months here? And they were quiet for a moment, and then one elderly woman said, we would like you to be able to tell us what happened. Because they really didn't know what happened. And so I took that request to heart, and across time in many, many one-on-ones and small group conversations and leading worship and dealing with the leadership group that was still in place, what I was able to finally put together was the story of what in fact did happen. And this is simply illustrative of the kinds of dynamics that can happen in a congregation without on the front end intending to do any damage or intending to create a problem. What occurred prior to my coming there is that they had 2 years prior done a search process for a new minister. And in that search process, they had put their search committee together, and they did so as is usually the case in certain denominations, where they're recommended to put together a search committee that is representative of the congregation, so that it is open, more balanced. And so they did. They put a committee together that was indeed representative of the theological diversity in this congregation, which in fact turned out to be quite polarized. But that polarization lived under the surface because everybody was having a great time with the programming of the church. So they were doing all kinds of things with kids. They had Bible study groups, and they were able to make that work until they hit this spot where they had to select a new minister. And what was at stake now was, what theological place were they going to hold on this continuum, And were they going to be able to meet the needs and speak the language, frankly, of folks who were at the extremities of this continuum? And so they went through the process. The search committee was balanced, but it was weighted toward those who were more progressive. And so the search proceeded, and they had enough consensus to extend a call to one of those candidates. The candidate, coming out of a more progressive place, accepted the call, and 3 weeks later notified the committee that he was withdrawing his acceptance of the call, which put the committee suddenly back into a crisis situation. And in the story that created the conflict, rather than going back to the process and picking up the process of a search, they simply went to their second choice, which was a person on the other end of the continuum, which set the stage for a real mess for them. So that minister came on board, had a much more a narrow view of ministry, of church life, and frankly, of who was invited in and who was not invited in. And after about 18 months, this minister pushed the board, which would be the session, pushed them to take a public stance on LGBT inclusion. And his position clearly was more conservative and at odds with the majority of those in the congregation who were more open, more welcoming, more progressive. When he did that, the church split deeply around this issue. And they finally rejected his pushing them in that direction, and it created a huge divide. But in addition to the theological difference, once a conflict issue arises, once a presenting issue arises, it can very quickly be eclipsed as an issue by people's reaction to one another in trying to address the presenting issue. So their behavior becomes the primary issue at some point. And the division deepens very quickly, with people looking for allies, talking with only those who agree with their point of view, finding ways to undercut the influence of those who were of a different perspective. So it got nasty in a hurry. And during that interim period, very much for me, my task was to try to help them in some sort of healing. So I want to talk about a little bit about some of the things I find that are sources of conflict in faith communities, talk a little bit about elements of healing and a process of healing, and then we'll have conversation with each other. Does that sound okay? Okay. You will find in your ring binder at the back a couple of resources there, one entitled Healthy versus Unhealthy Conflict, and it is a one-pager, and it gives you some of the dynamics around healthy and unhealthy. And beyond that, you'll see three pages lining out five levels of conflict, and some of you may be very familiar with these tools because they were generated through the Allman Institute, and so I've been the beneficiary of their work. The five levels of conflict was developed by Speed Lees, a longtime staff member of the Allman Institute, and you'll see the footnote on the other is Sam Leonard's work. Looking at some of the dynamics then and sources of conflict, number one, and these are not in any particular order of significance, it's just 10 things I find out there in working with congregations dealing with conflict, would be conflicting expectations around core values. Often these days, one of the things that happens in congregational life is that no longer is there an allegiance to a particular brand. People look for a congregation that meets their needs, and they could care less about its denominational affiliation. And so what happens then is that you have individuals coming into a congregation from many different traditions, and they bring with them the core values that they're used to in those previous settings. So they may be Baptists coming into a Presbyterian church, Presbyterians going into a UU faith community, UCC coming into a Methodist setting. So there's all kinds of cross-pollination, but what it generates is a very different understanding of how the congregation is to be a community together, and, not insignificantly, how it should be governed. And that's where a lot of the conflict can occur, when we don't take the time to help people understand what the process for decision-making is, or we don't help them understand what the channels are for raising a question or a concern and how it would then be processed. Number two, theological differences, basic beliefs, which tends to play out both in Bible study and in worship. Those theological differences can get identified pretty quickly. When I was a young minister, I understood one of my roles was to provide a Bible study for people. And they already had in place a midweek Bible study. And so I said to them, well, let's study the Synoptic Gospels. And I wanted them to be able to see from a more scholarly point of view how these things compared and contrasted and what one writer emphasized and another emphasized, and worked all the way through the process and what Mark left out that the others included. And I found myself pretty quickly in a very tense conversation. I was too naive and stupid at that point to know what water I was wading into. And so you can get into a conflict quite unintentionally just by stumbling upon it. Worship forms and rituals, also a place of conflict. How the faith community is going to live out its spiritual life together, what will be the style of worship, the forms of worship, the rituals that we hold in common that undergird our life together. Power and control issues can play all the way through a system at every level, everywhere from who's in charge of the kitchen to who makes decisions, and how are those decisions made? Are they made by a couple of people in the back room, or are they open and transparent? A process for decision-making becomes, even if there's a perception of a closed way decisions are made, even though it could be quite otherwise, it's helpful to keep the congregation involved in understanding what decisions are being made, what concerns have to be addressed, and how they're getting addressed, and by whom. Interpersonal issues, individuals with particular behavior patterns, with leadership styles, who may exhibit patterns of bullying or manipulation, individuals who seem not to understand the boundaries that are appropriate to the setting they're in, often can surface as problematic, and an individual's behavior can suddenly become the focal point for a pretty large conflict in the life of the system. Intrapersonal, looking at some of the stuff that goes on within individuals, issues that they've carried around for a long time in their little backpack that get played out in some really unhealthy and unhelpful ways. Secular business norms, ways of operating in a corporate business setting that get brought into and laid over the life, the ongoing life of a faith community can really drive people crazy. And I have seen it where congregations value the expertise that someone has from the business world because they have experience. They know how to manage money. They know how to take care of facilities. They have all of these practical things that they bring to the table. And they have a certain culture they bring with all of that that does not always align with the culture of the congregation. So are we making sense here? Everybody on board? Okay. We'll come back and unpack any of this you want to look at. Grief. Grief over past hurts. Grief over losses. In some settings, there'll be grief that is there, not too far under the surface, for the minister before the minister, before that minister before. Remember when so-and-so was here? It was just, he was such a great person. And it just isn't the same since then. And those individuals have never had a chance to really grieve. They've never had a chance to find closure. And so all of that stuff is still operative. Secrets. Secrets in a congregation can become toxic and operational, but not revealed. Secrets of the past, of things that have never been disclosed, that add to a dynamic of unhealthy interaction in the life of the congregation. In some of those secrets take the form of an abuse of power by the clergy leader, where they have crossed boundaries, where they have done significant damage, and where they themselves may have had to have been removed from the setting. As time goes on, that stuff gets pushed down, because it's an embarrassment, it's awkward, people feel guilty, they feel shame about it. And all of that stuff is in the room at many points in the life of the congregation. Institutional issues, governance, polity constraints, allocation of resources, all of those things can generate conflict in the life of the congregation. And then, as I indicated in my opening story, how a congregation takes a position on a particular social issue. Sometimes the minister, out of their own sense of their prophetic role, both within the congregation and the community, can step out ahead of the congregation in such a distance-making way that they will generate conflict because the congregation hasn't had a chance to come along to learn together, to study an issue, to really look at it through the lens of the faith community itself, and to find a way to responsibly move forward and address a concern in the community. And so they get frightened, anxious, and push back if they're not given a chance to learn and to move together around an issue. So those are 10 quick things that tend to bubble up in my experience, and I have found that I don't think it's me, but I get a lot of calls around conflict issues in congregations, and I attribute that in the larger landscape to the fact that many more congregations have become aware of their vulnerabilities. In the sweep of change that's happening across the culture, in shifting demographics, they had been able to stay a steady course, a relatively steady course, until they bumped up against something that they didn't know what to do with. And instead of trying to figure out what to do with it, typically then they would try to just ride on a steady plane going forward, not addressing the issue. And then I would get a call, we've got a conflict here, or we realize we are a congregation that used to have 150 in worship and now we have 45, which tells me they've waited much too long to look at their issues. And so now they not only have that issue, but they have all of the anxiety and stress and conflict around that issue that makes it so much harder to address and deal with. So let me stop there and see if, before we move on to looking at some other practical things, if you want to raise questions. Fred, can we get some mics up? Sorry, I didn't warn you about this.
Where was the hand?
Right here, yeah.
One of the things that really resonated with me was being compared to a former minister. I've been with my congregation for over three decades, and oftentimes I'm compared to myself. And that people will say, I wish we could have the old Fred back. And I feel like I've just been living out in partnership the vision and mission that I was called to do. You know, when the church was 180 and now we're, you know, close to 500, and my right. ministry, I was 33 when I went there. Great time for crucifixion, going back to. And you know, my ministry has changed, their ministry has changed, yeah. but there's, you know, I'm often compared to myself and or different stages along in my ministry. Sometimes it's every 5
yeah.
years that,
sure.
that there's a significant change. And so I just wanted to hold that up, that one of the joys and challenges of being in one congregation for so long is that people do compare you to your...
Yeah, in that amount of time, Fred, I would guess you've probably served three different congregations in the same place. That's very true. It's especially true if the congregation has a size transition and your role has to shift. People don't understand that, and they want the old guy back who used to spend much more time with them. Jackie has had that experience here. Doubling the membership here from 400 to 800 absolutely required her to shift her role in how she interacted with the congregation. She didn't have the same amount of time available, and people resent that. They don't understand that. They feel like she doesn't love them anymore. And so that's a point of stress, absolutely could be. Any other questions? Yeah, Rob?
So I think the only thing worse than bringing practices from the secular business world into the life of the church is poor business practice on the part of the church.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. do you have any wisdom to offer on how to bring in enough clarity from secular institutional life without... bleeding the faith out of it.
Well stated. Yes, and by the way, this says another implication for me. You and I were talking earlier about consulting with these systems, and what I have found is that some congregations will reach over into the business community to find a consultant to help them with an issue in their culture, and find that it's a total miss because there's not an understanding of that culture by someone from another culture. And I think that the key is that we do have in our congregations people with a real solid grounding in the faith community. They understand its core values, they live them out, they're committed to the community, and they have business skills. So wherever you can find the combination of that, someone with spiritual maturity who also has that skill, I think then you're not bleeding the spirit out of it. Yeah. Any other questions so far? Okay, so maybe I'll tell another story and then we'll take a look at another piece of this. I've just finished a consultation with a 600-member church that was embroiled in a very tricky conflict, and it was an interesting situation for me trying to sort of peel the onion, because every time I thought, okay, that's it, I learned another piece of information, and well, that can't be it. And so it got very complex and layered. And the basic storyline was that there were some folks who were very discontented with the minister and made some effort to try to reconcile and work out the issues, but I think had reached a point of such alienation and anger that they didn't really work at it in good faith, and they then wrote a letter of complaint to the regional denominational body. Now, in some polity, when such a thing happens, it triggers a process of investigation, trying to find a way through the issue, and can they find mediation and an agreement for how to resolve it. And the deeper in it went, the more intractable the combatants became. And when you get into a personnel issue like that, there are certain requirements of confidentiality that make the thing very delicate. We live in such a litigious world that in the process of trying to sort out a problem, you can make yourself as a faith community vulnerable to a lawsuit. I mean, it's just reality. And so everybody walks around on eggshells and tries to be careful about what gets said. And so one of the first casualties of this is transparency, because you can't be transparent. And you can't be transparent while, in fact, on one side or the other of the dispute, those individuals themselves are quite free to tell their own story as they see fit. And so you have a very loaded circumstance. And in this circumstance, the laity, by and large, were keeping faith with confidentiality. And so the dominant story that drifted through the congregation was the minister's story, who in fact was the subject of the problem. So in the process of going through the investigation happened, there were interviews, it was a whole full-scale deal. And it finally went to a trial because they couldn't work it out. So in a church trial, you have very much the modeling of civil action that takes place. It went all the way through the trial. There were four counts of complaint, and he was found guilty in three of the four, which, you know, it was a perfect storm in any case, but the result was that he finally resigned, but it left a very broken congregation. Some folks, having known this minister only in terms of the wonderful ministry he brought to them. He visited them in the hospital. He buried their spouse. He provided pastoral care. He stood by people in moments of trouble. That's what one part of the congregation saw. Those who worked closely with him saw a person who exhibited a pattern of manipulation, of bullying, of intimidation, and who rode roughshod over the governance of that congregation. When I looked at the constellation of factors, what became clear in time was that no individual concern seemed to be significant enough to cause the playing out of this judicial process. But when you pulled them all together, when you collected them all together, they really showed a kind of pathological pattern. And of course, if you're not really up close, you would not see it. The process, however, resulted in a very sharp bifurcation in that congregation, a split, people on two very clearly defined teams, or if you want to call them groups, and they were not talking to each other. And so if you look at the levels of conflict here, as they're described in that resource, they were at roughly a level four of five levels. But one of the things to observe for your purposes is that the level four conflict did not ride all the way across the congregation. There was a level four conflict among possibly 100 people of 600 people. And everybody else were floundering around just trying to understand what was going on, and some of them didn't even care. But among the 100, it had gotten so severe that it really then permeated and made toxic the whole life of the community. So the work of trying to help them find their way out of that really had to concentrate on those who were most engaged through the whole process. And not only was it between groups within the congregation, but in this case it was a serious conflict between the regional denominational body and the congregation. Now people were saying, let's have a conversation about withdrawing from the denomination, which really wasn't going to solve their problem, but it was going to satisfy their anger. and so that is still being hopefully resolved. But in that case, what you can see in that story is how quickly things can unravel. It happened very quickly. And when that occurs, the congregation is almost in a state of shock because they can't comprehend what's going on and they have no way of trying to control it or even to understand what they're observing. So in that case, what I find is that people need to be heard. They need to be able to tell their story from their perspective without being shut down by somebody with a different story from another perspective. So everybody needs to be able to tell their story in a safe space, which means that they need to agree to certain ground rules for how they're going to have these conversations. And so when I work with a congregation that's dealing with a conflict, I always start with the ground rules to get clear how it is we're going to work on this together. And I get a actual verbal agreement to those ground rules. And if I don't hear somebody or see someone assent to them, I will ask them very pointedly if they agree. And if they don't, I will challenge their participation because they're not at the table with, in my opinion, appropriate intentionality to work it through. They also then need, and by the way, in a case such as this, as soon as people begin to tell their story, the healing has already started. It's already started. Some people are already prepared to move on. Other people aren't going to move on for probably 2 or 3 years, and some people may never move on. Some will stay and never move on. Some will leave and never get over it. That's just, you know, numerically there's probably percentages about that, but I don't know what they are. In this case, they were able to sit down. We did focus groups, conversation groups, structured conversations. And the value of having someone from outside the system is that they come in with no particular point of view or axe to grind, and it helps create a leveling of the playing field. A question in the back. Yes.
So if we were to make some changes to the worship in our church and some broader ways that we interact with the congregation to move toward the beloved community. There's the potential for a level four conflict within a portion of the congregation.
You know that?
Potential. There's always potential for
okay.
that. Okay. What would you recommend in preparing for that and heading off it moving up to that level?
It's a great question and a very appropriate one. And one of the points I was going to touch on in this conversation. One of the things that I always encourage congregations to do is to give the congregation, and particularly the leaders, tools for understanding conflict and the dynamics of conflict before they're in one. If you're giving them tools after they're in one, they're much less likely to benefit from that. Also, part of what you're raising here is the dynamic of a change that you imagine needs to be made. And again, I like to encourage congregations to equip their members and leaders with tools for understanding the dynamics of change. What happens when a change is introduced? Give them a common language to talk about what they are going to experience before they experience it, so they have a way to talk about it together. In both of those cases, those are preparatory steps that I always encourage faith communities to take so that they have a way to process things as they're unfolding. The other issue there is, I believe, tell me your name, I'm sorry.
Mary Margaret.
Mary Margaret. I think you were in the worship piece earlier, am I right? So we talked there about changes in worship, and for those of you that weren't present for that, just very briefly, we talked about a process to help a congregation move along through a process of change in worship. And this is very important because what I've discovered along the way is that whenever you make a change in worship, you're not just changing a form, you're not just introducing new content, you're not just introducing an artistic expression. What you are introducing, potentially, and this would be the reason for a level four, you're introducing something that goes all the way down in here about what people value and how they express their faith. So it's not just about form, it's about, can I see myself believing what I believe within this framework of worship? Is it going to take away from me what I most value? Or does it have the potential of enriching and enhancing my experience? And so the preparation, once again, is a very important part of the process. And I described there what we did in one congregation was to hold, again, conversation groups. And the key question we asked was, what experience in worship have you had in other settings that was especially meaningful for you that you would like to see in this setting? And they started to talk to each other, which was marvelous because, of course, you know, people have been in other places. They travel on vacation. They go to other congregations. They see what other people are doing, and they walk away with, well, that wasn't very good, and they walk away with, wow, that was fantastic. And so when they were talking about the things they valued and appreciated that they'd experienced somewhere else, they gave us all the language we needed to talk about the introduction of new forms we wanted to make in that setting. So they not only heard each other, then we could feed back the language they used to describe those experiences, and then we could institute them. And so by that point, it was familiar. It was, oh yeah, I heard somebody, my friend said that in one of the groups. We talked about that. So it became more normalized, not threatening, but something, in fact, that we had all talked about. Does that make sense? That's just a way to get where you want to go without having a without generating a feeling of what we're about to do now has nothing to do with what we've done before, which people receive as, oh, we've been doing it wrong all this time. Or you don't really care about me. You just care about somebody else that's not here yet that you're trying to reach. You know, it might be a case of that. Great question. Any other questions right now? Yeah, Fred.
If you don't want to go here, that's great. We can talk later on. But in the first, in the story you gave, sound like a couple colleagues of mine. In each of those situations, and I don't know if it was true here, that person's colleagues knew that that minister had a reputation for the bullying and the, you know, all of that. And so my question is, what is, I hope you can answer this in a way that's not only meaningful to the ministers here, but the laity, what's the role of that minister's colleagues in that situation? You know, so many times it's like they form a union, you know, yeah, get them, you know, go, you're doing nothing wrong, and that kind of thing. But how do you walk with that person while at the same time saying, you know, there's something going on here and you need to look at it, you know?
Yeah, I would say, maybe a couple of things. Maybe the most harsh thing I could say in that regard is if a colleague has reached a place where they're so angry at their people that they don't care about the impact on them of something they're planning to do, they need some help. They need a spiritual guide, they need some therapy, they need somebody to help them work out the stuff that they're now visiting upon the people of their congregation, which is not helpful. They either need to find a new call, or they need to get some help to square it around. And I think if we have a sense of being truly being in covenant with each other as clergy, then I think it's entirely appropriate for somebody to say something to somebody about the dangerous way they're moving forward. And we all know congregations can be resistant and entrenched, and sometimes you want to dynamite the place to loosen it up. But there are ways short of doing that that you can loosen it up. And I think, as in my case, I didn't get those tools in seminary. I had to get them afterwards. And I had to seek them out because nobody was offering them to me. So I had to go really search for those capacities and learn them. That's true for all of us, and it's one of the reasons we value these kinds of gatherings, is that it's a time to look at, reflect on our own work, but also to maybe pick up some additional things that we don't currently have. But I think it is appropriate to raise questions with each other. In my case, I was, as a United Methodist, I was in a supervisory role with clergy. I had 80 churches on my district, and I had 66 clergy, some full-time, some part-time. And it was my job to try to keep their fat out of the fire, in one sense, but it was also my role to try to resource them and listen to their story so that I could pick up how they were feeling about where they were and what was going on. Because we all know you can get deeply frustrated when you're trying your best to strengthen a congregation and they don't want to get any stronger. They're happy, thank you very much, with who they are. Unwilling to realize that their resistance to looking at how to get healthier is certainly going to contribute to their demise. And so at some point, there needs to be some honest heart-to-heart, and we need to resource the leaders of those congregations with materials to read, with case studies of other situations, help to bring to the surface that they, in fact, are vulnerable, and they really need to look at that. And I was in a situation where I saw my congregation was seriously vulnerable, and the community had changed demographically. They were isolated. The two clergy before me hadn't really done the work to help them look at their realities, and they were living in la-la land and very happy to be there. From my point of view, I felt it was my call, duty, responsibility to do my best to help them, in fact, talk about what was going on. And so I did try to do that. They grudgingly allowed me to set up a study committee that generated a report with recommendations. When the report came back to the congregation for decision-making, some of the leaders of that congregation went out and recruited people who had moved away but were still in the rolls, got them to come back for that meeting and defeat the proposal. Unfortunately, and the most difficult thing for me was, I had to preach to that congregation through the next year before I could get out of there. That was the hardest thing I think I've ever done. It was also a seasoning of me as a young person that eventually served me well, but it took a while for me to embrace that something good came out of that. Pardon? Yes, the question is, what was my resource and what sustained me through that? Well, here's what happened. During that year, I was, after all this had played out, I was there another year, and during that year, I took a day. I went to Princeton. I had looked up in the phone directory, which they had phone directories back then, and I identified all of the consulting offices that were listed on Nassau Street. And I walked from one end of Nassau Street to the other, and I just dropped in cold, and I said, I understand you do consulting work here. I'm interested in that, and I wonder if there's someone here who could tell me what you do. And they were delighted to tell me what they did. And at the end of the day, I had one job offer, which at that moment didn't pay me enough to take it. So all of that is to say, I didn't have adequate resourcing. The system did not really show up for me, which later on, when I was in a role representing the system, I knew I needed to show up because I had been in a time when nobody did show up. I had friends, a couple of friends, who really showed up, but systemically, in terms of the system, no. But some friends really did show up and listened to my Trail of Tears story, which helped, but it was a hard year, hard couple of years. Other questions? That's one of the things that is really important. We are in a time, folks, of heightened anxiety in our congregations. People are concerned. They don't know how they're going to make it. Smaller congregations are feeling the press of the economic squeeze. They have managed to go along for a long time, just kind of coasting along. Volunteers would come by and slap some shingles on the roof when they had a leak, or they would find a way to keep it all glued together. Now, however, that's getting harder and harder to do. And so anxiety goes up. anger rises, frustration. And if that becomes sort of the dominant dynamic in the life of the congregation, you've got a real problem. Yeah. Yes.
So I serve as middle judicatory, and so if I were to show up, what might be like the top five things that congregations need that you see, especially living into a multicultural future? How can we show up for our churches?
You're in a middle judicatory role? Great. What's your name?
Renee Rohatsky.
Thanks, Renee. Yeah, okay. So I can tell you from my experience what I focused on in my situation. One was I knew that clergy were not well equipped for the challenges they were facing. And so I did two things. One, in my one-on-one interviews with clergy every year, I paid a special attention to what kind of continuing education they were taking. And some of them were taking the same continuing education every year for the last 20 years. And so I intervened and I said, no, you need to find some other resources for yourself. The second thing I did was to organize continuing education opportunities within my own setting. Either I would do some of that, or I would invite other people in who had certain capacities and skills to do that, and invited the clergy to come and be in those experiences. So leadership development became a very important piece of the puzzle for me. I also paid attention to the laity on my district, and we did have a pattern of lay training annually that was pretty well supported by the laity. Beyond that, what I did, because I had 80 congregations, it was not humanly possible for me to be with all of them in the ways that they, it was the same as a congregation. They all wanted me to spend a lot of time with them and hang out and celebrate what they were doing and hear their stories. I had to, after the first couple of years in that role, by then I had enough information to make some strategic choices about where to spend my time. So you can't be everywhere. You can do some things generally that are invitational to everyone, but then I found it much more productive. I selected 12 congregations of the 80 that I covenanted with, because that's the other thing, is that if somebody doesn't want the resource, you're wasting your time. But if they will covenant with you around some potential they have to move forward, then you have the basis of a relationship, and you can go in and work with them more intentionally. I had at one point designed a series of training events that were held in the congregation as a whole. So I had the whole leadership core sitting down together, not just the clergy, not just the laity, but the whole team together for some capacity building experiences and help them think about where they were going and how they imagined getting there. So those would be a couple of things I would suggest. And then beyond that, frankly, there was a lot of firefighting that just had to be done. And so you had to intervene, you had to be present, you had to try to help them through whatever the conflict was. And usually it was with the clergy, because when a system gets under stress, who is it who's most responsible? It's the minister. And if they don't show up and they can't fix something and they can't fix it soon enough and they can't fix it the way they want it fixed, then they become the focus of the dissatisfaction. And that results in a request for the person to be moved, or they just hammer away at them until they decide they want to move. But that's a conversation to make transparent also. And that has to do with helping people understand what the dynamics are that are going on right there and get them up on the table and call them what they are, so that they're not allowed to play out under the surface in some really destructive ways. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Rob.
So one of the things I admire most about Middle is that Middle is stepping up as a flagship to partner with other congregations.
Mm-hmm.
In what you just outlined, what I heard missing was how we can covenant with those 12 that are worthy of your attention and have the capacity to change, to serve as the flagships,
as the models.
To serve as not only as models, but as consulting congregations.
Oh, great, great.
With the other 78.
That's absolutely
great. Or 68.
That's great. So that's helpful. So one of the designs that I put together was to identify congregations of different size, to bring them together for conversation with each other around what was working. So by size, by measures of effectiveness. We brought them together to tell their story and began to extract out of the stories what were the learnings. So we compiled the learning, and then we had that to share with others so it could ripple out. And not every one of those congregations had an interest in being a flagship or taking on the additional task of trying to help somebody else. But those who did were helpful in the conversation. That took a lot of time to do, but that can work well. And maybe I can share that with you at some point. Yeah. Anything else at this point? Maybe we could talk a little bit about healing. And we've kind of jumped around here and talked about some of this. One of the other things that come, just a couple of compounding and contributing factors when a conflict emerges, it jumps to behavioral issues very quickly. We talked about that, and people need to be held accountable and given boundaries so that they're not constantly doing injury to one another. Secondly, communication is a serious issue, and this whole thing of lack of transparency. What can be done in a case where you can't share out what some of the nitty-gritty is of a conflict is to at least tell the congregation why you can't. There's some of these settings, they get into these binds, and there's a lack of information. And when there's a lack of information, you suddenly find these incredibly creative people who will create the story that they don't hear. And they will fill in the blanks. And as soon as they start to fill in the blanks, it's a circus. And all kinds of things are being asserted. So when you can't share out publicly or even privately what some of the issues are, you can at least inform the congregation about why that's the case and help them understand that there is a process of care. There's also a process for protecting the congregation in a potentially litigious situation. And as much as you all would like to know all the details, we cannot share them with you right now. Try to direct the energy to sensitivity to one another. And this is what takes me to the suggestion that the congregation, if they haven't already done so at that point, they need to develop a behavioral covenant with each other. And there's a publication from Alban some years ago by Gil Rendell. Some of you may know the book entitled Behavioral Covenants. And I always encourage congregations. Well, I really don't encourage them. I require them to develop a behavioral covenant as part of the process of working their way out of a conflict situation. I haven't had anybody say, no, we don't need to do that. They know they need to do that. And they will work on it, and they tend to do a pretty decent job. And I give them resources for how to do that. And by this point in time, they can even find resources online. But my suggestion is have a behavioral covenant before you think you need one. Do the work now if you're not in the middle of a conflict situation. Take time to talk about how do we want to be a community together. What are some of our rules of the road? How are we going to structure our life together to be caring, thoughtful, understanding, and still leave room to question, challenge, and push the congregation in directions that are healthy and helpful. So that kind of work is very helpful to do before you get into a mess. The behavioral covenant is something I asked them to do as part of the consultation process, and engaging the organizational structure of the congregation in some specific actions they can take toward healing. What I find is that people want something concrete to do to help them move out of the mess and toward a more positive circumstance. And so if you can give them specific, concrete, actionable things that they can work on and do, it helps to shift them out of the mess and toward and put them on a path toward healing. And then finally, restoring a spirit of playfulness, which I have found to be really important, because they get so shut down and so fearful, and they've been through a rough patch, and people have wounded one another, and so they shut down partly because they don't want to become the object of somebody's bad behavior, because they've seen what happens with that. And so everybody shuts down, tiptoes, only talks to those they feel safe talking to, and the spirit of joy is totally stripped out of the place. And so helping them recover some, and you'll always find help with that, because there's some joker in the place that wants to have some fun. And so I encourage that, and they can help each other at that point. Also, worship can help them do that. It needs to be more celebratory. They need to see that they're not locked in this dark place. They can move out of that dark place. They can become out of this experience an even more informed and more mature community than they were before this happened. So it really needs to be a focus on how we play together, and some of that can be structured, and some of it just bubbles up organically among the community. I think beyond that, I just refer you to the Healthy versus Unhealthy Conflict Index, and there's a couple of things there that I might want to highlight. One is a basic attitude in congregations, whether some congregations theologically think conflict is bad, and so they don't even test one another. They'll just ride along and be cranky. But in fact, to help normalize the notion that some conflict, if it's handled well, can actually contribute to and enhance the life of the community. When disputants then are in a healthy situation, disputants can see the difference between people and the issues. They don't make the people the issue. Unhealthy, it is obviously the reverse. Communication in a healthy situation is open and transparent. In an unhealthy one, it's controlled and confined and limited. In a healthy situation, people aren't dragging things from the past into the current conversation, saying, you know, that's how we've always been, and they're dragging old stuff into the current circumstance. In unhealthy circumstances, people are going back over 20 years with all their grievances and bringing them up to the surface again. A congregation is interactive or it's reactive. In some circumstances, you can't really touch an issue without somebody blowing up or something blowing up. When it's interactive, people are talking to one another. Communication is open and they have a spirit of cooperation. In terms of acceptance or denial, in a healthy situation, people are able to say, yeah, we have a problem. They can own it and they can work on it. In an unhealthy situation, we don't really have a problem here. Or they want to resolve it so fast that it's really not resolved. It's just painted over and it'll bubble up. Just give it a minute. And timelessness, a sense of the way we deal with issues is we stay in community together until we work it all the way out. It's uncomfortable, it takes time, it is work, and we understand it is our responsibility in this community to stay in the conversation until we can come out the other end. And of course, the opposite of that is we want to dispose of this as fast as we can and not deal with it. Act as though it doesn't really exist. Any other questions? So, give people resources before you need them around conflict and change. Have the conversations among your leaders. Develop a behavioral covenant if you don't already have one. Talk about things before you're in a conflicted situation. Look at the five levels there, and you'll get some clue about when you need to access outside help before it reaches a critical point where it's really now much more complicated. Okay, we good? Thank you all. Great.